Chúng tôi muốn nói lên sự thật cho giới lãnh đạo được biết. Chúng tôi là Pacifica Radio KPF.
Good evening, welcome to another edition of the Sunday Monitor. This is Mark Rabawi along with Perky Anderson. We have a packed show this week. Three live interviews on three different subject areas. The first interview will be with John Nichols. Nichols is the DC correspondent for The Nation. He's the author of three books. The first is called It's the Media, Stupid. The second, Jews for Buchanan. And his latest is called Against the Beast, a documentary history of American opposition to empire. That'll be our first interview right after the news. The second one, we'll take a quick break between those two, will be about daylight savings time. If you've ever wondered who created it, well, we have a live interview with Michael Downing on that subject. He teaches creative writing at Tufts University. He's the author of many books. His latest is called Annual Madness of Daylight Savings Time. And closing out the show, we have a live interview with Ray McGovern. Ray served for 27 years in the CIA's Intelligence Analysis Directorate and now serves on the steering group of Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity. We'll talk to him about the recently published report by the Commission on the Intelligence Capabilities of the United States regarding weapons of mass destruction. If you want to read part of that report before we get Ray on the line, go to www.wmd.gov. That's all coming up. We have, like I said, a busy, busy show, and we'll start off with a couple of news headlines in the meantime. In Iraq, there have been several conflicting reports today about an attack on the Abu Ghraib prison. The attack was carried out by Iraqi insurgents or resistance fighters, depending on whose reports you read. Reports of U.S. casualties in the attack vary between 44 and 56 or 58, none of them fatal, at least according to most reports. KGO Radio in San Francisco did mention 18 U.S. soldiers killed at one point. The host of the show asked the audience very pointedly whether the coverage by the U.S. media about the Pope was more important than covering the largest single-day loss of U.S. life, largest single-day loss of life of U.S. forces in Iraq. So far, I have been unable to confirm this figure in any reliable sources. We'll continue to watch the story. If you have any sources on that story or any comments on that story or anything we cover in the show, send us an email. The address is sundaymonitor@journalist.com. Abu Ghraib prison houses about one-third of the prisoners the U.S. is holding in Iraq. There are currently no reports on any arrests of those who carried out the attacks. One U.S. soldier at the scene, Lieutenant Colonel Guy Rudisill, said that one attacker was killed in the clash, but none were detained. He didn't give any further details. A U.S. citizen is also being held in Iraq by the U.S. The Bush administration has declared a small number of U.S. citizen enemy combatants eligible for indefinite detention without charges. The citizen in question in this case is being held at one of three permanent U.S. prisons in Iraq, believed to be the Camp Cropper facility for, quote, high-value detainees, unquote. This is in Baghdad International Airport. Rachel Meripool of the New York-based Center for Constitutional Rights said, quote, this is a direct violation of a Supreme Court decision. The Supreme Court decided that an alleged enemy combatant who is also an American citizen has the right to challenge the factual basis for his detention and has the right to do that through counsel. This man has clearly been denied both opportunities. If they are going to hold him, he should be charged. This is an administration that simply does not seem concerned with following the rule of law, unquote.
Thanks, Mark. On Tuesday, the New York Times reported that one of Florida's most visible TV reporters was also earning nearly $1 million from the government agencies he covered. His reports appear on CNN and most Florida NBC stations. The reporter, Mike Vasilinda, is a 30-year veteran of the Tallahassee Press Corps. His production company, also based in Tallahassee, has earned more than $100,000 over the last 4 years through contracts with Governor Jeb Bush's office, the Secretary of State, Department of Education, and other government entities that Vasalinda frequently includes in his news reports. One of his biggest state contracts was a 1996 deal that paid nearly $900,000 to film the weekly drawing for the Florida Lottery. Vasalinda told the Sarasota Herald Tribune that his business dealings with state government did not influence his reporting. He said, quote, "I have processes in place to make sure the products we put out for our news clients are free from bias from any source. We absolutely keep arm's length between the two divisions of our company." But Bob Steele, a journalism ethics professor at Poynter Institute in St. Petersburg, said Vasalinda's state government work, quote, "certainly raises some red flags," unquote. The issue of conflicts of interest in those who appear to be journalists has been a steady drip, drip, drip since January. It began with the revelation that Armstrong Williams, a conservative pundit, had been paid nearly $250,000 by the federal government to promote the No Child Left Behind Act. That's been followed by several other journalists with conflicts of interest. Vasalinda said his situation was nothing like the situation with Armstrong Williams because he had not personally promoted any government programs or appeared in any of the videos his business produced. The New York Times said it was so far unable to obtain copies of the contracts from the agencies. It said Governor Bush's spokeswoman did not return calls seeking comment. Governor Bush's chief of staff also did not return phone calls, and CNN did not respond to questions from the Herald Tribune.
Emails by several government scientists on the Yucca Mountain nuclear waste dump project suggest workers were planning to fabricate records and manipulate results to ensure outcomes that would help the project move forward. A U.S. Geological Survey employee wrote in one email, quote, "I don't have a clue when it comes to these programs when they were installed, so I made up the dates and names." He sent this an email. It was released on Friday by a congressional committee investigating the suspected document falsification on the project. He went on to say, quote, "this is as good as it's going to get. If they need more proof, I'll be happy to make up more stuff," unquote. He also went on to say in the same message, quote, "in the end, I keep track of two sets of files, the ones that will keep QA happy and the ones that were actually used," unquote. QA refers to the quality assurance testing at Yucca Mountain. The emails were in a batch of correspondence released in advance of next week's hearing by the House Form Subcommittee on the Federal Workforce and Agency Organization. It's chaired by Republican John Porter from Nevada. The Energy and Departments revealed that the extent of the emails on March 16th, and inspectors general of both departments are investigating. The FBI is also conducting a probe, according to a subcommittee staffer. Yucca Mountain, approved by Congress in 2002, is planned as the nation's underground repository for 77,000 tons of defense waste and used reactor fuel from commercial power plants. The material is supposed to be buried for at least 10,000 years before beneath the Nevada desert, 90 miles northwest of Las Vegas. One of the emails by a scientist on the Geological Survey said, quote, "science by peer pressure is dangerous, but sometimes it's necessary," unquote. The emergence of the emails was the latest setback for Yucca Mountain, which also suffered money shortfall and an appeals court decision last summer that is forcing a rewrite of radiation exposure limits of the site. The Energy Department recently abandoned the planned 2010 completion date, and the department's officials haven't given a new date yet. Well, that does it for this abbreviated news summary for this week. We'll take a very quick break, and we'll come back with author John Nichols. Stay tuned. You're listening to the Sunday Monitor on KPFT 90.1 FM in Houston. This is Mark Babawi along with Pokey Anderson. We have our first guest live now. That is John Nichols. John Nichols is the DC correspondent for The Nation. He's the author of three books. One is called It's the Media, Stupid. The second, Jews for Buchanan. And the last, which we'll be talking about in some detail today, is called Against the Beast, a documentary history of American opposition to empire. John, welcome to the show.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
Well, thanks for joining us. So we're going to kind of team you here because there's a lot of material to get through and we're going to be, I suspect, pushed for time. So I think Oki Anderson is going to head off with the first couple of questions and I'll jump in at some point during the interview as well.
Well, I hope I can keep up with the both of you.
Well, we do have quite a bit of material here. It's an amazing compilation that you did. And I heard you interviewed by Wally James here on the Progressive Forum, and I've been bugging Mark ever since that we should get you on. So I'm
That's
glad you're here.
Very generous of you. I appreciate it.
And you know, now that you're here, we'll probably be calling you again because I know you have lots and lots of topics of interest. Let's start off with a quote from a fellow named Thomas Mott Oz, 1900. That you included here. Imperialism is not alone a series of acts. It assumes that there are two grades of human beings, those who are entitled to rule and those who must submit to be ruled, and that the latter may be utilized for the benefit and profit of the former. It assumes various forms and sometimes covers itself with a cloak of religious cant, but at the bottom is always the same greed of gain. True anti-imperialism denies the right of any set of man or any people to assume authority over any other people. It denies the right to decide for that people what shall be its political in the world. This was in 1900. I think that's a great kind of summary of what you were looking for. I mean, tell me about why you wrote this book you were trying to do.
Well, I thought you picked a perfect quote. And that was by, you know, Thomas Mott Auburn was a prominent political figure at the turn of the century. He gave that speech at the convention of a third party that was actually started in 1900 to explicitly oppose the annexation of Hawaii and the seizure of the islands of Puerto Rico, Cuba, and the Philippines after the Spanish-American War. And when you go through the book, you'll find hundreds of quotes like that from all sorts of folks, people like George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, James Madison, Abraham Lincoln, Frederick Douglass, Helen Keller, you know, Jane Addams, right up to people in the present day like Patti Smith and Robert Byrd, all of whom expressed a deep and healthy understanding of the damage that imperialism does, not just to the country that is targeted by the forces of U.S. empire, but also to the United States itself. The United States is made a weaker and lesser country when we embark on a career of empire. And I wanted to communicate to folks, especially to younger readers, that when they become furious about the war in Iraq or the occupation of Afghanistan or any of a number of other activities in which the United States is currently involved, they're not doing so in isolation, and they're not unpatriotic, and they're not un-American. They're doing so as part of a rich American dissenting tradition that sometimes has prevailed, and that, if anything, we need to gin up. We need to make stronger today. So really, this isn't a history book so much as a call to action.
Well, let's go back to around 100 years ago. It seemed like things were kind of popping then.
They were.
it seems like no matter what topic we cover here, we end up right around, you know, 1892 to about 1910, 1920. It's quite an interesting period. And so Hawaii gets in the gun sights of at least some corporations that had settled in Hawaii. And I had never really heard any of this story.
Most Americans haven't. We don't teach history in this country. You know, we teach history. We teach sort of a vapid kind of sub-patriotism. It's closer to propaganda than history. But the fact of the matter is that the seizure of Hawaii, done at the behest of the Dole Pineapple folks with the U.S. Marines, is a classic example of gunboat diplomacy, of, you know, the old, you know, today folks go out and march with signs that say no blood for oil. Back 100 years or so ago, you could have had a sign that said no blood for pineapples.
So the Queen of Hawaii never really surrendered, right?
No, she was a wondrous woman, and the story is incredible. Hawaii is a small population, very indigenous folks, and they had a royal family. The Queen was very modern, very literate, very liberal, and quite well liked by her people, by all accounts. And when she was removed from power, She chose not to have some sort of violent response, but to believe, as many did in the late 19th century, in the kind of dawning era of diplomacy. And so she wrote these incredibly poignant letters to the President of the United States saying, hey, you know, your Marines seized my country. And the amazing thing about it is that President Grover Cleveland, the Democratic president who served from 1893 to 1897, got the letter, read it, and agreed. And he ordered the U.S. flag to be taken down. He ordered the Marines to leave. And he began a process of trying to give Hawaii back to the Hawaiian people. Unfortunately, and this is a big lesson on the importance of elections, in 1896, a Republican named William McKinley came to power. He immediately reversed all of Cleveland's actions and completed the seizure of Hawaii. But there but for one election in 1896, Hawaii might remain an independent country in the Pacific.
Well, and Hawaii, it seems, starts another whole level of imperialism, because it instead of just Manifest Destiny going out from the East Coast to the West Coast of the U.S., then all of a sudden, you know, we're halfway around the world.
Mm-hmm, exactly. And that was a big breaking point. The wonderful thing to know about America is that even when Manifest Destiny was taking place, when the U.S. was invading Mexico or annexing Texas, or forcing the Indians onto the Trail of Tears, there was opposition, angry, passionate opposition, led by obscure folks like Abraham Lincoln. And so we've always had those who understood the damage that is done. But people really became much more engaged at the turn of the last century, because the United States was beginning to look an awfully lot like a classic colonial power, seizing islands in the Pacific and the Caribbean, starting to get engaged in the wars of Europe, sending our, you know, farm kids from the rural Midwest off to fight the Kaiser's war, you know, or fight against the Kaiser in World War I. And so there was a lot of anger and a lot of energy that arose at that time. And really, when you read the book, the most passionate opposition to empire, some of the most wondrously expressed opposition, done not just by politicians, but by poets and humorists like Mark Twain, who was a passionate foe of empire. The other thing that's interesting at the turn of the last century is that a group of people entered into the kind of leadership role in opposition to empire that had never been there before, and that's American blacks. And they, in the post-Civil War era, they beginning to develop their own newspapers and vehicles of communication. They looked at the seizure of these islands and what was being done to the indigenous people, and many of them, as former slaves, fully understood the impact of what was going on.
Well, actually, you anticipated my next two comments. I was going to quote Mark Twain, as you did.
Yeah. Well, you can quote him. His quotes are fantastic.
He's always quotable, satirizing the idea of annexing Hawaii. He said, "We must annex those people. We can afflict them with our wise and beneficent government. We can introduce the novelty of thieves all the way up from streetcar pickpockets to municipal robbers and government defaulters, and show them how amusing it is to arrest them and try them and then turn them loose, some for cash and some for political influence."
It's a wonderful quote.
And we can give them railway corporations who will buy their legislatures like old clothes. It's pretty great.
Now, and Twain also had, at the start of the book, I have a wondrous brief quote from him where he was asked by an interviewer if he considered himself an anti-imperialist, and he said, "I am an anti-imperialist and against having the eagle grasp some other country in its claws."
Exactly. Let's jump over to Haiti.
Another quite a remarkable story.
I have to say, when all the stuff was happening recently with Aristide being flown out and so on, I was completely ignorant. As you said, we don't teach history here. I was ignorant of the history of Haiti and that it had been a republic. It was the second republic in this hemisphere.
And in fact, Haiti in many ways is America's greatest success. And that is that the founders of this country, the best of them, and they were a mix. Remember, there are some pretty bad folks in there too. But the best of the founders believed that America should be an example to the rest of the world. And lo and behold, in 1804, the slaves of Haiti, inspired by the American Revolution, revolted against their slave masters and wrote a Declaration of Independence and Constitution based on the American model. And so for the better part of 100 years, fits and starts meant much of it imperfect. The Haitians built their own republic, their own, you know, at least fledgling democracy. But at the start of the 20th century, the United States began to meddle vigorously in Haitian affairs and finally sent troops to occupy the islands, and they were there for the better part of 20 years. So the current occupation is nothing compared to what we've done in the past.
So, just interrupt you just for a second. John, can you give a little bit of the context for that meddling? What was the U.S. aim in Haiti at the time?
Sugar.
That was it?
I hate to be...
That was the oil
yeah,
of the time.
That they wanted to... Believe me, there was an awful lot of racists in power in those days, including Woodrow Wilson, who was the president. They weren't looking to, you know, bring a whole bunch of relatively poor African... black folks into the U.S. But the Haitian islands were well-positioned as sugar-growing regions and also as regions for producing some other crops. Additionally, they were well-positioned in the Caribbean for shipping. And the United States had recently seized control of Cuba and Puerto Rico and had a lot of other interests developing the Caribbean, and Haiti was a convenient place essentially to seize. And I wish I could give you a much more romantic image, but the fact of the matter is that when you begin to look at the history of U.S. imperial activities in the Caribbean, especially in Latin America, to a somewhat lesser extent, but generally the same, you see that it's all economically driven. It was only the Cold War in the 1950s that began to give, you know, sort of an excuse for some other reason to be there. But remember, most of the countries that we talked about in the 1980s being afflicted by U.S. imperial desires, El Salvador, you know, Guatemala, Nicaragua, were all places that the United States had invaded and occupied prior to that period. So, I mean, you have to recognize that it wasn't communism that got people concerned about the Caribbean or about Latin America. It was gunboat diplomacy. You know, it was all, you know, it was dollar diplomacy, as George Norris used to say, the desire to go out and send U.S. sons and daughters to die in order to ensure the interests of U.S. corporations.
Let me jump back, I guess, a half a century, and then I'll let Mark bring us up a little closer to the present. Speaking of race and economics, I hadn't thought that much about how the expansion with the Louisiana Purchase and so on was partly propelled by people in the South who wanted more slave states. And of course, cotton growing had, with the invention of the cotton gin, had become incredibly profitable.
The Louisiana Purchase was a real revelation for me as a writer, because I thought I knew a lot about American history, but that was an area I didn't know that much about. And I was absolutely defined that New England writers were full of 8-4 who were angered by Jefferson's territorial desires and said, look, this is dangerous for a couple of reasons. One, expansion of slavery, bad idea. Two, taking on new territory that this young country couldn't afford to manage, bad idea. And three, a very thoughtful notion that perhaps it wasn't healthy for America to get too big. That if we were going to maintain a genuine democracy or something, you know, we weren't a genuine democracy, but if we're going to maintain this experiment and try and move in the right direction, it would become harder if we became much larger. And so there were very thoughtful discussions 200 years ago about some of the same issues we're talking about today.
Well, I know some people have talked about splitting the country into six pieces so that democracy wouldn't be so far away.
I hate to tell you, there's some Northerners that would still let Texas go.
Not
me on radio. I'm glad to be on.
Well, we'd have to move KPFT to one of the blue states.
Come on up to Wisconsin.
Well, you mentioned land acquisition in Texas. I was going to talk about more recent stuff, but I'm tempted to go back and talk about Texas a little bit. Mm-hmm. The third chapter of your book is about the annexation of Texas. Can you just give us, a lot of Texans and a lot of Houstonians that I've met are not originally from Texas or from Houston, and they may not be aware of the history of Texas. Just give us a brief thumbnail sketch of what happened with that before we move to more current events.
I mean, Texas was part of Mexico.
Right.
And rather peaceably so. In fact, the Mexicans were, pretty decent lot. They didn't believe in slavery. They generally allowed people from what was the United States to come and settle there and weren't too rough on them. But there was a group of folks who came out and wanted to expand slavery into Texas. It was really part of the broader struggle in the whole United States at that time, which was to whether the non-slave states or the slave states would get the majority. And there was this passion to get Texas in as a slave state. That was politically untenable. And so the folks who were pushing that drive made Texas a republic. They declared independence. You have all the stories that you folks know better than I about the Alamo and things like that. But ultimately, Texas was a republic for a very short time, a matter of a few years. And from the very beginning of its status as an independent republic, there was agitation to have it annexed by the U.S. There was a tremendous debate in the late 1830s, early 1840s, about whether to annex. And it was really a debate about slavery, not about territory. The opponents of slavery didn't want Texas. The supporters of slavery did. And when you look at the people who lined up on the opposite sides of it, it was fascinating. You had Ralph Waldo Emerson and Abraham Lincoln and all sorts of people who we look back on with great awe today opposing the annexation of Texas. The supporters, again, mostly slaveholders. And they ultimately prevailed in 1845, and they prevailed in a way that's so typical of what's happened throughout our history, and that is that it wasn't really about Texas at that point. It became more and more about this agitation to seize even more Mexican territory in what's now California, Arizona, and New Mexico. And so at the same time that Texas was being annexed, you saw the launch of the Mexican-American War of the late 1840s, which was really our ugliest, in many senses, and cruelest imperial war, and one that is, again, almost lost to history, but important to understand that among the most bitter foes of the Mexican-American War was Abraham Lincoln, who actually lost his seat in Congress because he was such a militant foe of that war. He was the Barbara Lee of his day.
Well, I just wanted to remind listeners who we're talking with. It's John Nichols. He's the D.C. correspondent for The Nation. He's author of several books. We're discussing his latest, a documentary history of American opposition to empire called Against the Beast. And, John, the book is full of quotes, and some of them are from people that have been on the show, including Gore Vidal and Chalmers Johnson and others. And I wanted to give just one that Chalmers Johnson said, as a way of bringing us up to more sort of recent events. And he said, the United States likes to think of itself as the winner of the Cold War. In all probability, to those looking back at blowback a century hence, neither side will appear to have won, particularly if the United States maintains its present imperial course. So Chalmers Johnson and blowback and more recent events, it sort of struck me that there hasn't been an awful lot of change in intentions and in methods of policy. And I guess the question I wanted to ask you, and if you could frame it in the context of what's happening today in Iraq and Afghanistan and other places, is has this always been the nature of government internationally? Has it always been the nature of government in the U.S., and what prospect for change is there?
It's a very good question, a very depressing one, I'm afraid. I'm not going to speak to government internationally, although I will say that the tendency toward empire and colonial adventure on the part of nations that achieve a certain amount of economic or military power has always been a problem, always been a presence. But with the United States, we've entered into a new and very dark period in our history that is characterized not merely by the traditional economic instincts and even by the traditional militaristic instincts. There's also a sort of messianic desire to put the U.S. imprint on other countries. This is a break even from the imperialist tendencies of the past. In the past, you had folks who, they lied, which was healthy. You know, they would say, oh, we have to go to war with Spain because they blew up the battleship Maine, or we have to attack Vietnam, we have to send troops to Vietnam because of the Gulf of Tonkin. I mean, these were lies, and they were spread both by bad politicians and by a rotten media. But today, we actually have a president who, although he may lie about a lot of things, doesn't lie about his desire to basically put his U.S. stamp on country after country. And it's a very unhealthy place for a republic to be. I think we've entered into a period where, as a country, we desperately need to have a debate about who we are when we grow up. We've become an old country. We're not a young country anymore. Old countries begin to think that they ought to be able to tell the rest of the world what to do and do so permanently. Britain fell into that trap, and you can go back and find examples of it all the way back to the Roman Empire. And we as a people need to talk a lot more about this. That's one of the reasons I wrote the book, to suggest that those like Robert Byrd, who stand up in the Senate and talk about an ill wind blowing over the Republic and speak the word empire, speak the word imperialism, are not nuts. They're not extremists. They're not fools. They're not, you know, some sort of, you know, echo from a distant time. They are the real clarion call of our moment. And we as citizens have to recognize that we've entered into this dark stage. Now, once we recognize that, we're going to see a lot of things that are constant. You know, imperialism always is powered by sleazy politicians who want to use a faux patriotism to win elections. And it's also always made possible by a horrific media, a media that does not choose to cover issues in a realistic way, that doesn't cover the world, and that tends more to stifle debate than encourage it. And I have to tell you that in this period, you know, aside from your wonderful station and a few others like it, we have a media that really does an incredibly lousy job of covering fundamental debates about where the country should go.
Well, I guess one of the things that struck me about your book is that it sort of creates the impression that there are people on the extreme right and people on the extreme left that have a lot in common.
Absolutely.
You know, Pat Buchanan and Gore Vidal are not names you would often mention in the same sentence, but they seem to share the view that, you know, foreign adventures and government secrecy are bad for the country.
And so does, in Texas, Ron Paul,
right,
and Lloyd Doggett.
Yeah.
You know, your most progressive member, I would argue, or one of your more progressive, and easily your most conservative.
Well, I have one final quote that I want to throw out, and it's from Paul Wellstone, and I know Pokey wants to ask a question about him. So one of the things he said, and this was back in 91, he said, "I think that relying on the military and not giving economic sanctions and diplomacy a chance has scrambled the Middle East and will unleash forces that there are unknown and unknowable. Tremendous anger will be directed at the United States, Beirut writ at large." This is Paul Wellstone in response to the Gulf War of 91, Bush Sr.
And doesn't it suggest, I mean, what I was amazed when I got to that quote, and obviously I had to put it in the book, was, I mean, take a look at that and understand, you know, September 11th, 2001, and remember the reality that Osama bin Laden said that his inspiration, his driving passion for hating the United States was the stationing of U.S. planes on Saudi soil in that first Gulf War, exactly what Wellstone was talking about.
And just a question that I have that doesn't really relate so much to your book as to the at-home issues.
Mm-hmm.
I take it you knew Paul Wellstone.
Very well.
Yeah.
I knew him from the start of his Senate tenure all the way through. In fact, that final weekend, he died on a Friday, and that final weekend I was going to be up in Minnesota covering him.
After the tragedy at Red Lake, with the teenage boy shooting family members and then people at his school, I was thinking about Paul Wellstone. One of his last visits was to a Native American group. He had fought to alleviate poverty and mental illness. And I thought about the kid and, you know, whether he has any advocates in, you know, Minnesota elected politicians or at all. And where, you know, what kind of vacuum did that leave?
Oh, Wellstone's loss was immense, and I always tell it this way. If he had, the polls show that he's going to win the election after having voted against going to war in Iraq. If he had won that election and other Democrats who had compromised on that issue had lost, there would have been a huge swelling of national sentiment in Wellstone's direction. Progressives, Democrats would have looked to him. You wouldn't have seen the Howard Dean phenomenon or the Kucinich campaign or any of these other things, because the passion, the demand that Wellstone run for president would have been overwhelming. And frankly, he had an interest in running for president. So our politics would have been radically different. I can't tell you that Wellstone would have won the Democratic nomination and been president of the United States. I don't know that. But what I do know is that if he had run for president in 2004, the war would have been a front and center issue. It would have been impossible, no matter who won the Democratic nomination, not to address it in a much more responsible way than John Kerry did. And the issues that I talk about in the book, issues of empire and imperialism and the damage done not just to other countries but to the United States by pouring our treasury into these military misadventures, would have been at the center of the debate rather than pushed to the periphery. So in losing Paul Wellstone, we lost an advocate for that kid up in Minnesota and for all those other kids. But we also lost one of the few politicians, not the only one, thankfully, but one of the few who was determined to put the kind of issues we've been talking about for the last few minutes on the political agenda. It was a terrible loss.
Well, John Nichols, it's been, it went by way too fast.
I agree.
We got two more guests to get on, but we'll have to have you back.
I'm honored to be with you, and I do thank you for taking some time to talk about these issues. They are important.
Well, I appreciate you putting them together in a book for people. Against the Beast is the name of the book. The author is John Nichols. He's based in Wisconsin and does Capitol reporting for The Nation. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks, John, for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. We appreciate it. We're going to take a very quick break. If you think the time is 5:35, it's not. It's 6:35. And if you want to understand how that happened, our next guest will explain it to you. That's Michael Downing. That's coming up right after this break. Stay tuned.
Back. This is Pokey interviewing Michael Downing. Welcome to the show, Michael.
Hello, Pokey.
Glad to get a hold of you. You managed to turn your clocks forward?
I seem to be on the correct time, whatever that is.
Michael has written four novels. He also teaches writing at Tufts University. And he got it in his head to write a book about daylight saving time. It's called Spring Forward, The Annual Madness of Daylight Saving Time. One of your friends said you kept asking questions about this, and it made her head hurt. What was going on? Why did you think this would be an interesting topic?
Well, I thought it was an interesting topic because one October I looked at my hand turning back the clock to fall backwards, and I realized I had no idea what I had been up to for 45 years. And I thought, well, my friend Shirley will know. And when I asked them, they repeated to me the same myth I had grown up with, which is that we do this for the farmers. And it really struck me as a little bit dubious that I was helping American agriculture by toying with the hands of my clock.
You'd never seen a cow change her watch?
I'd actually never seen any of the farm animals with their watches on. And I was kind of surprised that, 10 minutes of research taught me what it would teach anyone, which is that the farmers hated daylight saving from the beginning. They were the most opposed group in America. And it turns out that farmers actually used morning sunlight time. So losing an hour of morning sunlight for them gave them one less hour to get the work done of getting eggs, produce, and milk to the cities. So that was really when I thought, maybe I should figure out what I've been doing for 40-plus years.
Well, let's go back. We were just talking to John Nichols about the period around, 1880, 1890. And let's take you back there, too. Tell us what was going on with the railroads and how many local times they were having to run their lines through.
It's an astonishing moment in America. Until 1883, we all lived by local time. So that meant people looked up at noon, set their watches, and cities within 15 miles of each other often had times that were half hour to an hour different. This, of course, became problematic for railroads, which were trying to predict the time in the cities of their destination. And so in an amazing moment in American history that's really sort of under-researched, I think, and certainly a story that's too little told, the railroads invent standard time, the time zones, and without any intervention or help from the U.S. government, they simply impose the time zones, divide the nation and the North American continent, in fact, into four time zones, and they create these four commercial sectors. And then within a year, the entire world adopts time zones, and we're all on these estimated approximate times. And most importantly, it turns the nation away from the sun and onto clock time for the first time.
And the whole idea that hours would be a way that you would sell your labor, too, became much more of a big deal, right?
It became a tremendously important idea. This, of course, was deeply affecting to farmers who were used to needing people for different numbers of hours every single day, or particularly seasonally. And so, of course, this leads to 60 years later, Franklin Roosevelt codifying the eight-hour day and creating a notion that if we're going to have workers who are going to be, you know, paid, we have to make sure that there's a kind of fair wage. And the beginning of fair wages really begins with the eight-hour day. So there are some benign aspects to this clock time. But for most workers, until at least World War II, the clock time was genuinely punishing. You know, it was the first time that people didn't get up at what they thought of as the normal time with the sun, but had to be at a factory at a particular moment according to a clock.
Well, the standardization of time kind of moves forward in fits and starts, to say the least, according to your research. Well, so what happened in the 20s with radio?
Well, radio really had a problem with daylight saving when the nation experimented with it. And it turns out that, of course, this makes sense. Radio were doing local broadcasting. And so what happens is that some cities are on daylight saving time and some cities are not. Most suburban areas and rural areas are not on daylight saving. So take a city like Houston. If it happened to adopt daylight saving, its clocks were an hour later. That meant radio that broadcast to Houston and the suburbs had to have two 7 a.m. news broadcasts. This drove radio nuts because, of course, many of the things that happened on radio were meant to be live, like setting up exercises, physical exercises for people to do. This meant that the poor guys in the studio had to do two sets of all their exercises just to get their work done in the morning.
That sounds terrible.
They found it punishing. But they weren't alone, of course. The movie studios hated daylight saving time because it actually turns out that if you give people an extra hour of sunlight in the afternoon, they will go outside and they'll spend less time in the movie theaters.
Well, the role of Congress and state legislatures in this is, well, let's just say I had them in low esteem already, but they dropped even farther. They're buffoons.
Well, it's the greatest comic document of the 20th century, the Congressional Record. It's genuinely hilarious, and the testimony that is given to it by both commercial interests and private interests is really worth a look. Congress stepped in to the daylight saving debate during World War I and imposed it on the nation. It was so fantastically unpopular, they repealed it in 1919 after only 2 years. We don't get another national daylight saving law until World War II. In between, what happens is fascinating. Congress repeals the national law and New York City immediately passes its own city ordinance without regard for its state legislature's will or the Congress's will. And the reason really is two-part. New York City is acting on behalf of retailers, particularly the big department stores, who understand that with people working in factories, an hour of daylight at the end of the day means people can see into the shop windows and will go in on their way home. And also, Wall Street needed daylight saving to keep 1 hour of overlap with London, which was 5 hours ahead by standard time, but using daylight saving. New York adopts it, and then there's a wildcat craze of cities adopting daylight saving despite their state legislatures.
Well, some of the quotes are pretty amazing. Like this one guy, Hugh Vail, was against daylight savings time, and he caps off his argument by saying, "Then when communism comes, what are we going to do?" And you know, they wrap this stuff in, you know, God's time, and I mean, patriotism, of course. You know, well, we're in a war, we have to save energy. Well, where did they get their energy statistics?
They made them up largely. The whole story, I mean, the pleasure of writing Spring Forward was really the preposterousness of the debate. That, as you say, fundamentalist preachers lined up against daylight saving on the basis that we were being taken to clock time off of sun time, which they like to call God's time. So there was a religious objection to it.
I haven't seen God with a watch either.
And yet, here's the deal. It didn't help that the first Sunday the nation went on daylight saving was an Easter Sunday, according to the Christian calendar. So a tremendous number of people turned up late to churches, further angering their ministers. I have to say, there is a fantastically good-natured clergyman in St. Petersburg, Florida, who noted that it's an odd fact that in October, when we fall backward, people never show up an hour early for church. But there were, besides those kinds of objections, there were also people who were simply poignantly confused by the whole notion of time. And one of the things daylight saving time does for all of us, I think, is it makes us penetrate the veneer of our clocks, and it tells us that, you know, time, clock time is an invention and can be manipulated. And if we can manipulate it so easily with this little mechanical gesture twice a year, we begin to realize probably time can be manipulated by other people and not always with regard for our needs.
Makes sense. A couple of times in here, you noticed that American troops were fighting wars, and the Congress kind of ignored that and debated daylight saving time.
It's an amazing fact that we can't get a peace treaty after World War I. Wilson cannot get the Congress to sign a peace treaty, and instead the Congress is spending its time really vociferously debating daylight saving. And the same thing happens in World War II. Franklin Roosevelt is eager to have the country join the European effort in the war against Germany. And daylight saving time is so fantastically contentious and unpopular that even after the bombing of Pearl Harbor, Franklin Roosevelt, in order to get a daylight saving law passed in this country, has to do it under the rubric of wartime. And when his administration later asks them to extend it because the country is in such dire straits and they're hoping to use it to squeeze a little energy saving, the Congress ignores him and just gets off of daylight saving time. It remains one of the most astonishing facts that this single apparently tiny issue generates more political controversy and takes up more time in the Congress than any other legislation of the 20th century.
There's one point where you mentioned that in St. Paul there is an office building of 18 stories. 9 floors of it had city employees on one time, and 9 floors had county employees on a different time. Is that the worst example of the crazy quilt?
It certainly ranks up there. This is by 1965. We have a nation with 130 cities with populations over 100,000. 130 big cities. 59 of them are not using daylight saving, 71 of them are, and all of them are adopting daylight saving on different dates. So some start in March, April, May, June, or July. It gets to the point where one airline reports it's getting 4,000 phone calls a month from customers just wanting to know what time it is in the city of their destination. The U.S. Naval Observatory, which is meant to be the clock keeper for the country, says that the world's greatest economic power has become the world's worst timekeeper. And that's really the moment when the Congress steps back in and says we need a Uniform Time Act.
Well, given that this whole business of time was linked to God, and that, you know, Congress, of course, was in there making big speeches, and the crazy quilt and how it changed back and forth and it got emotional, would it be that perhaps in a few decades we'll look back on this time and say that the issue of gay marriage, which, you know, is locally legal in one place and not in another, and if a couple steps across a certain invisible line, they're not married anymore, will we look back and say, gosh, that was kind of crazy?
I think it's a great analogy. I think it's absolutely right that the Massachusetts court decision has just changed the future entirely by making people who are in this state recognized as a sanctioned couple, let's call it that for lack of a better term, understand that that identity is not geographically specific, and that and that's precisely the history of the daylight saving story, which is that people began to realize that the geographic separations were inventions which didn't hold up against the idea that they wanted to know what time it was in their cousin's home in Oklahoma or their best friend's home in California, and they didn't want to have to consult a chart to do that or consult a higher authority to do it. So I think uniformity, there really is a generousness in the spirit of most people, which, exposed to the possibility of a more generous social policy, they will respond to it and hope it's extended to other people.
Well, I am completely out of time, Michael, but now I think I know a little bit about this crazy thing we call daylight saving time. And I really appreciate you coming and joining us.
This was a pleasure, Pokey.
Michael Downing, author of Spring Forward, The Annual Madness of Daylight Saving Time. Thanks a lot.
Well, from daylight saving time maybe to reputation saving time, I want to talk to Ray McGovern about a very serious subject. Ray McGovern has served in the U.S. CIA's Intelligence Analysis Directorate for 27 years. He now serves on the steering group of Veterans Intelligence Professionals for Sanity. Ray, welcome to the show again.
Glad to be with you, Mark.
It's nice to have you join us again. On the 31st of March last week, the report by the Commission on the Intelligence Capabilities of the United States regarding weapons of mass destruction, a bit of a mouthful, which was established by presidential order in February, published this report. And I'm going to do my best to give a quick thumbnail of the report's conclusion, and I want you to respond to it in the time that we have left.
Sure.
The conclusions seem to me that the commission is saying that the U.S. intelligence agencies were not explicit enough in saying how much of their assessments were passed on conjecture or speculation rather than hard facts. The fault, they say, lies with the intelligence agencies, not the administration. First of all, is that a fair summary of the commission's finding? And then what's your response to it?
Yeah. Well, Mark, you pointed out that the commission was commissioned, so to speak, last February. And the reason it was commissioned was simply that David Kay came back, and after spending $1 billion of your taxpayer dollars and putting to work some 800 specialists, they could find no weapons of mass destruction. And this was a major blow to the administration, although it was not a big surprise. And the president typically appointed a committee to look into it to report back when, well, after the election, of course. So that's why we don't get the results until just this past month, March 31st. Now, the whole name of the game was to perpetuate this myth, and it is a myth, and the myth is this. The intelligence was bad. The bad intelligence made me do it. In other words, the bad intelligence made the poor president make a war where really there was no provocation, there was no need to make a war, and so he did it anyway, and it was all the fault of the intelligence. Now, what people don't realize is two things. One is that decision for war had nothing to do with the intelligence, because there was no intelligence when the decision was made to make war in Iraq. That decision was made quite irrespective of any intelligence.
And that's a very important point. Can you just flesh it out in a little bit more detail?
Sure. Well, it's very interesting that the very first National Security Council meeting that the president, new President Bush, arranged on the 31st of January 2001, that whole meeting, virtually the whole meeting, was devoted to how are we going to get Saddam? When can we get him? Give me a way to do it. How best to get Saddam? And we know that because Paul O'Neill, the Secretary of the Treasury, newly sworn into the job, was aghast. You know, he said he wrote a book about it, and he said, you know, I really thought maybe someone would discuss why we needed to get Saddam or what kind of danger he posed. So 9/11 made it very easy because the president was able to conflate, the president able to identify Saddam Hussein with 9/11, even though there was no identification, there was no cooperation between al-Qaeda and Saddam Hussein. So all those decisions were made very early, and it was only when they came back from vacation in 2002 and somebody says, okay, well, we're going to have this war. What do we need to do? And somebody said, well, you know, there's this Constitution thing, you know. What do you mean? Well, the Constitution reserves the right to make war or to approve war, authorize war, to the elected representatives of people in the Congress. Mr. President, it's not you. Well, no problem. Let's persuade the Congress. Well, Congress, derelict in its duty for many, many months, finally said, well, what does the intelligence say about this? And then, my friends, and only then, was an intelligence estimate ginned up, conjured up out of thin air with all these weapons of mass destruction and other dastardly things that the Iraqis had in mind for us to deceive Congress into forfeiting its constitutional prerogative to declare war. It worked like a charm. And that's why we had the lousy estimate. Was the intelligence bad? The intelligence was inexcusably bad. Did it have anything to do with the war? Just to the extent that persuaded our lawmakers, deceived our lawmakers into approving it.
Now, as this estimate was being drawn up, something pretty unprecedented happened, and that was that the vice president went to the CIA several times. That's something that's never happened before. Is that true?
That's exactly true. I spent 27 years there, and never did we have a vice president come for a working visit to CIA headquarters up in Virginia. The procedure has always been, you know, we would go to them. I did it every other morning myself for a period of 2 years. So Vice President Bush, Herbert Walker Bush. And, you know, if he needed more detail or if he were interested in a subject that needed more clarification than I could give him, nobody knows everything about everything, obviously, I would volunteer to bring down the experts, and sure enough, I'd bring them down, and he could ask them all manner of questions, and that's the way it worked until Vice President Cheney decided that he needed to go up and help the analysts by asking them the questions and making sure that they knew what the, quote, correct, end quote, answers were. What's really odd is that the head of the analysis division said that she didn't know how many times Cheney went out there for visits. She thought it was between 4 and 8. Now, that's really odd, because all she had to do is check with the security people and find out how many, unless he had free reign of the place and came in there at other odd times. But he came there, and he obviously was exerting undue influence on these young analysts. And who do I fault? Whom do I fault? I fault George Tenet. He was responsible for protecting his analysts from that kind of pressure, and he didn't do it.
Well, we have about 2 minutes left, unfortunately, and I wanted to ask you a quick question on Curveball. An informant, there's a story in the LA Times yesterday about an informant that was supposedly ignored by CIA officials in 2002 and 2003, and I want you to answer this question, if you can, in the sense of if the intelligence community is going to fall on their collective swords about all this and the commission's report, or are we going to see a rash of leaks and complaints about what's being said in public?
Well, there's a little bit of intramural wrangling now as to who didn't tell whom about Curveball. But the best source for that is the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence report of last July. And that reports that only one American had seen Curveball. He worked for the Defense Intelligence Agency, but he reported to a senior official at the CIA. The night before Colin Powell spoke at the UN on 5 February 2003, this analyst who had seen Curveball read the text of Colin Powell's speech and was aghast. And so he wrote an email to his superior saying, you know, this is crazy. This guy is a drunk. He doesn't know much about these subjects, and he isn't who he says he is. We can't let Colin Powell say that. And in the extant email that he got back, and we have this, it's in the report, his superior said, look, there's going to be a war, and our job is to give the president the ammunition he needs. If you think that, quote, the powers that be, end quote, care very much about whether Curveball knows what he's talking about or not, you're being very naive. Black and white, right there. Now, that's the unforgivable sin in intelligence process, intelligence analysis. You don't cook the facts. You don't shave the truth. You tell it like it is. So it's very painful to watch that.
Yeah, and I guess that sort of summarized the whole process. I wish we had more time to discuss it, but I'm sure there'll be more reactions from you and more articles. There was an article by you in the Miami Herald on Friday, which I would encourage people to look up online. I want to thank you for your time where I have to go, I'm afraid.
Thank you, Mark.
Thanks a lot. That was Ray McGovern, 27-year CIA veteran. Before him, we had a couple of guests. One was Michael Downing. His book is called Spring Forward. And before that, we had John Nichols. His book is called Against the Beast. For Pokey Anderson and Byron Jackson, I want to say thank you for listening. Our email address is sundaymonitor@journalist.com. Feel free to drop us a line with comments or questions at any time. We'll be back next week at 6, and hopefully we'll see you then. Good night.
Pacifica Radio.
Anasot Radio Pacifica al KPFT 90.1 FM for Houston.
Unasikiza 90.1 FM KPFT Houston.